He was lecturing mostly at Nankai University, but then he toured to many different parts of China, lecturing to labor and women's groups as well as teachers. He's back in America for a very short stay. In about 10 days, he leaves for Cuba, where he's been invited to lecture on American labor history at the University of Havana. This will be his 12th visit to Cuba since the revolution. Dr. Philip Foner is best known for his books on American labor history and black history. His over 80 volumes include his 4-volume history of the labor movement and of the United States, his 3-volume Women in the American Labor Movement, Organized Labor and the Black Worker, and the life and writing of Frederick Douglass. Philip Foner has been a professor of history at Lincoln College and Rutgers University. He's also led seminars for the members of Solidarity, and he's lectured at universities in many different parts of the world. He's spoken with us before on Fresh Air on labor history, current labor issues, and the black history of Philadelphia. Philip Foner, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Welcome back to America.
I was hoping you'd be able to visit with us in between your trips to China and Cuba, so I'm really glad we're able to work this out.
Well, I promise, so I'm keeping my promise.
How did you get the invitation? Who invited you, and what were you asked to teach?
My invitation was rather unusual, because professors who go to China to teach either come through Fulbright fellowships or State Department fellowships, or exchange between a university in the United States and a university in China. But I didn't fall into any of these three categories. First two, that I'm not quite certain that either Fulbright or the State Department would have recommended me, because my views aren't exactly considered to be in keeping with the establishment viewpoint. And then I was a professor emeritus at Lincoln University, which has no connections with China. So what happened was that an old student of mine, who had once studied with me in the United States and is now a important professor at the Institute of World History, has started the ball rolling to get me to come to China, and finally worked very hard and found a sponsor, namely Nankai University in Tianjin, or formerly Tientsin, and which has one of the two American history research groups in China. Wuhan is the other one. And they knew my books, both in Chinese, because several of them had been translated, The History of the Labor Movement, and in English, and they were very happy to sponsor me. So I was invited by the president of Nankai University, and not to teach the students in Nankai, but what they arranged was teachers in universities and normal colleges, that is teachers' colleges, from all over China, from out of Inner Mongolia and everywhere, were sent by their universities to study with me for 2 months at Nankai. And their universities paid for their stay at Nankai. And they studied with me in American labor history from the formation of the AFL to the formation of the CIO. They will be teaching this, so they were very anxious to study with me.
Where does that knowledge fit into their curriculum at Chinese universities?
Well, a whole change is taking place in the curriculum of the universities. The Cultural Revolution, which you may have heard of, devastated the study of everything. And now, for the last few years, they're attempting to recover from the awful effects of the Cultural Revolution, which lost interest in almost any kind of studying, and scholars, professors were sent out of the universities. Many of the universities were closed down. They lost contact with all the latest studies in their fields, American history, American labor history. So now they're engaged in a sort of a catch-up effort to try to learn as quickly as possible new developments that had taken place in those 10 or 12 years when they had studied nothing to any practical extent. And so they were very anxious to learn my approach and the old labor history, the new labor history. And there's a considerable amount of tremendous amount of energy that's going into trying to catch up. So you didn't have to worry about attentive students. They were, in fact, at first I taught them twice a week for 2 hours, of course, with an interpreter. But then they felt they should get more, and so they sent a petition to me to extend the class to 3 hours. And I did that at their request. And then I gave them a special seminar, apart from labor history, on racism in American life, sexism, and other subjects, as well as historiography, and then two sessions on the Chinese worker in the United States. Now, all of these lectures that I gave were taped, and they are going to be published in both English and Chinese in China. So apart from the students themselves who are getting this information, it's going to be made available all over China. And so when I left Nankai and to teach at other universities, being understood that these lectures would be made available, I had to give different lectures, and I talked on different subjects. For example, at Fudan University, a very interesting university in Shanghai, where I lectured for 2 weeks, I gave entirely different lectures, one on the American Revolution, one on Jeffersonian democracy, Jacksonian democracy, two on the anti-slavery movement, one on the Civil War. And those two are going to be taped and are going to be published. And then I gave a special lecture in Shanghai for the Shanghai Historical Association for middle school teachers who were brought in from 200 miles away who teach American history on recent historiography in American history. They didn't know anything of the new American history. In fact, one of the things I found and helped to put a stop to was they were translating books into Chinese and American history because they hadn't done anything in the Cultural Revolution, which were 10, 12 years outdated, no longer valid, most of the thing, because they didn't know these things. So I brought them up to date on Black history, Indian history, women's history, ethnic history, new labor history, this new social history, all the things they knew nothing about. And, well, they were very happy to learn about it.
Did you find any glaring areas of misinformation or stereotypes that didn't apply?
I would say to a certain extent, but yes, they did have certain conceptions of, for example, in the civil rights, one of the reasons in Peking, I gave six lectures for special audiences of trade unionists, minority group representatives, women's groups, and others. Three on the current labor movement in America, the current scene, the background and the problems of the labor movement, and three on the civil rights revolution. Now, one of the misinformations they were strongly influenced by was that Martin Luther King was not really a leader of the black people. That he was more, because of nonviolence, he represented a sort of a pacifist person who had no mass following. Whereas Robert Williams, you may not even remember that name, who went to China, he wrote a book called Negro with Guns. He was very popular in China at that time. They still believed he was the only real mass leader. Of course, that was misinformation. But generally, I would say it wasn't the problem of misinformation.
But of no information.
Now, some people there are trying very hard to make up, I mean, professors, for example, who studied in the United States, University of Chicago or other universities, and who know English fairly well. Their problem was that they had no books. Well, that's a problem all over China. It's almost a glaring contradiction in a sense, and I felt very sad at times. All this desire to study American history, American labor history, and black American history, women's history, but with nothing. There was a graduate student at Northwestern University who was studying there, and he was doing his PhD on McCarthyism. And he knew that I had been before the senator several times, and he asked if he could meet with me and go over his subject. Well, it was, in a sense, pitiful. He had no books. He had one or two books to write his thesis on. They are very sadly lacking materials. We're trying to do something to supply them with books and microfilms and other things. Of course, there are professors and students, graduate students, who are coming to the United States. Temple has several now, University of Pennsylvania. But not everybody can come to the United States, for one thing. And if all the people who want to study American history in China are left without materials, and only the people who come to the United States can do the work, it'll be very sad. So one of the problems is that I hope to help to overcome is to get things to China so that the students and professors there can do their own work there studying and up-to-date materials.
Was there any tabs that were kept on you by the American government or any regulations that you had to work within from the Chinese government?
No, the American government, so far as I know, we had no relations whatsoever. So if they wanted to keep tabs, they could have. It would not be the first time I would have experienced such a thing, so it didn't bother me. As far as the Chinese were concerned, no. They wanted me to give them anything I knew. They were very anxious to hear what I had to say on these subjects.
What was Nanking University like? I think of American universities as frequently being, well, in part because it's the place where young people become adults, both intellectually and physically and emotionally. There's a lot of, you associate universities with free thinking, cultural experimentation, political radicalism sometimes, particularly during certain periods. But is there that sense of experimentation or of really feeling how far you can go with your life?
Well, first of all, a Chinese university today is quite different than an American university. The term university is perhaps a misnomer in terms of our use of the... If we take, for example, University of Pennsylvania, Nankai University, Peking University, no university in China today is like the University of Pennsylvania in this sense. They're mainly liberal arts colleges. The old days when the universities had a medical school, an engineering school, a law school, such as we have in American youth, that was ended in the 1950s. So the engineering school is separate. The school of finance is separate. The medical school is separate. So the university is really a liberal arts and science place. Therefore, it's not surprising that instead of having 30,000 students, such as you might have at Berkeley or other place, you might have 4,000 students only at Nankai, because it's basically a liberal arts school, you see. It is a college, and there is some graduate work being done. On the general question of what it's like for the students, well, for one thing, you have to remember the physical plant is very poor. One reason for that is that during the Cultural Revolution, the universities were totally neglected. Many were shut down. Many were not allowed to function effectively. There was such a complete contempt for scholarship, for learning, for professors. I mean, if I were to tell you the stories of what happened to the professors.
Tell us a couple of stories.
Well, for example, on one occasion, I was really touched personally because in Jinan, which is a very, there were two universities, Shandong University and Shandong Normal University. That's only for teacher training. Quite a lot of the colleges are normal colleges. I was lecturing at both, and the head of the history department at Shandong University, Professor Liu, knew my books very well. He was an old admirer of mine. In fact, I will say that going to China was a very good experience for my ego, because every place I went, everyone said, we knew your books since the 1950s. We've been grown up on them. We've studied American history. And we never dreamed that we'd see you in person, you see. So it doesn't make you feel bad. Well, he told me a story. We were climbing up the mountain of the 1,000 Buddhas, which means that there were 1,000 different depiction of Buddha in that mountain, sculptures, etc. Very beautiful. And when we get to the top, he said, I must tell you a story that what happened during the Cultural Revolution. He was a great admirer of my 4 volumes, Life and Writings of Frederick Douglass. He wrote a book on the Civil War, and he studied Douglass very intensely. Now, each one of these volumes has an introduction by me as a biographical section of Douglass for the period of the volume. And he took out these four introductions, which make a complete biography. In fact, they have been published as a separate biography. And he decided he was going to translate that into Chinese and publish it so that the Chinese audience would know Frederick Douglass, the great American black abolitionist leader. He spent 6 years at it, 400,000 Chinese characters, and then one day the Red Guards and the Cultural Revolution took it and destroyed it on the ground that it dealt with a foreign figure. And he argued with them that it was Frederick Douglass, a great black militant, but it didn't matter. So that was one example. A lot of things were destroyed, books, statues, ancient manuscripts, how many they lost that were just wiped out.
What was the rationale people
the were rationale
that?
Was a, in the beginning that the universities and the professors were elitist and had lost touch with the people, that it represented a bourgeois mentality, and they had to be brought down. But of course, what happened was that the baby was thrown out with the water very quickly. So in the process, the universities became the target altogether. Learning was denigrated. Professors were regarded as anyone, as an enemy of the people. One of the professors at Shandong, Fudan, he had to walk, go to school every day with a bearing a sign on him, which said that he was a stinking number nine. In the old ancient China, there were the breakdowns of what people represented. One, two, three, four. The lowest of the low was number 10. Those were the prostitutes. Number nine were the intellectuals. Of course, that was the ancient times. So they revived this idea that the intellectual is among the lowest of the low, and he had to parade himself in the front of the people that way. He was the chairman of the department. He had been educated. They even concocted a story that he was trying to organize a branch of the Ku Klux Klan in China, which even those people who were friendly to the Cultural Revolution thought that was so outlandish that they couldn't swallow that. But that's only some bizarre examples, but there are many. Did you see the film From Mao to Mozart?
No, I haven't.
Well, there's an instance there which shows how the head of the Shanghai Conservatory of Music was punished for allowing Western music to be taught and played, including Beethoven, and was put in a solitary confinement for years in prison. And that was what happened to many. They were sent out to the countryside to work with the farmers with two results. The farmers found the professors not good peasant workers. They felt they were more a burden than an advantage. And the scholars and professors lost 10 years of knowledge of their particular work, you see. So the whole thing was a terrible disaster.
So this has this caused a lot of cynicism amongst intellectuals?
Oh, yes, especially among students. That is very widespread.
What form does it take?
Well, you see, when the criticism of Mao's later actions, the Great Leap Forward, and his participation in the Cultural Revolution has helped to cause a feeling that, who is right, you see? If the great men are wrong, how do we know that the great men today are also not? In other words, you make mistakes. Mao made mistakes. But how do we know that 5 years from now there won't be another group that will come in and say, the present group made mistakes? In other words, a cynicism has developed that we don't have anything to say about these things anyway, so who knows whether it's going to be good or bad. There's many young people are mesmerized by the United States. They listen to Voice of America. They're studying English. Well, if the number of young people who want to come to the United States is overwhelming. When I would walk into the park nearby the hotel where we stayed for a month, My wife was also teaching English conversation, so she was with me. And you walk into the park, and of course, the moment they would see Americans, all the students from the universities that were there would say, can we talk English? You know, they wanted to practice their English. And, well, that same thing happens in Japan, but so you get used to it. But they had the most fantastic attitudes about America. For example, they believed that in the United States, everybody, every young man could go to college very easily. Also, there was no unemployment among young people. Life was good for everyone. And a lot of this, they said, I said, well, where do you get these ideas? Well, partly they got it from Voice of America, they said. Another thing, they said, well, Fulbright professors who taught them gave them some ideas. Well, this is fairly widespread.
Yeah. I guess I'm surprised in a way that because of the on-again, off-again Cold War, I should think that some people in Chinese would think that Americans are so caught up in capitalism that life is not very fulfilling. And that they wouldn't like it here.
You have to remember that some young people may not regard capitalism as not unfulfilling. I'm not saying that's true, but you see, one of the problems, and this is not true only in China, one of the problems that all socialist countries have is young people who don't remember what life was like before, and think, therefore, and always view life as greener, pasture is always greener, and therefore have a cynical attitude towards the society. And whatever the government says is not very convincing to them because they've been sort of convinced that the government mainly hands out propaganda, you see, and that's a problem.
How much propaganda is there, do you think?
Well, in any socialist country, it's hard to say how much propaganda there is. There is criticism of a sort. For example, if you read, I don't read Chinese, but the China Daily, which is a paper that's put out in English, and in fairly good English, not Chinglish, and has, by the way, the best sports page of any English language paper on American sports outside the United States. I was able to keep up with the Eagles very easily and with the Phillies and their baseball experiences, plus the tennis and everything, because they have a very good, because it's largely for tourists, you see. So they do put a lot of emphasis. But they have a page, a section of letters from people who criticize what's going on. That is, they don't like, they'll go into a department store and find the service is very poor, and they'll write a letter, and this is investigated. Or the post office steals, they say they never get the books that they pay for, and when they go to the post office, nobody pays attention to them. Now, that is allowed, you see. But beyond that, there isn't too much, but it's interesting to read these letters.
Speaking with Philip Foner, if you're just joining us, and we're discussing his trip to China. He just returned about, I guess, a week or two ago. He's off to Cuba in about 10 days, where he'll be lecturing at the University of Havana. He was invited to lecture at Nankai University, and then also lectured at a number of other universities, both to teachers and people from the women's movement and labor movement. In China. Now, you started to talk about how young people not used to conditions before the revolution
are becoming very cynical.
Is there a generation gap in politics?
I would, not only in politics, there are peculiar customs. There's even a gap among the young people in some ways. For example, one of the things I'm indebted to this from knowledge more from my wife than myself, because my wife, in teaching English conversation, was able to get them to talk to her very often, and whereas I was lecturing mainly and couldn't on American history, whereas she was using their life and their lifestyle as a way of encouraging them to talk. For example, they have when they get married in China, they still have the husband-to-be must provide the bride with certain things, which they call a number of legs. In other words, unless you can provide means a table has four legs, a couch has a certain number of legs, and a bureau. So many young ladies who are getting married will, with their family, will say, how many legs can you provide me with before they will agree to be married? On the other hand, the more liberated young people shun that. And but it's not easy, because if you work in a factory and all your colleagues are proud of how many legs they got, and you're saying, I didn't get any because I'm liberated, you're not looked upon with being very smart. But China's customs are quite different in many ways from the West. Feudalism, China has a long history of feudalism, feudal society, and remnants of feudalism are still present, especially in the countryside, and they make for difficulty in trying to modernize the country.
I know that you met with women from the All China Women's Federation, and they asked you about feminism in America, and you asked them about women in China. What did you learn about women in China?
It's interesting to ask what sort of questions they asked. They were, for example, one of the questions they asked was to me, what are the prospects for the enactment of the ERA. They're very interested in that. I from my hearing the Voice of America and other things, I didn't hold out too much hope at any rate. But that's what, also they wanted to know what about unemployment among women? What about equal? What is the thing about equal pay in a new dimension? Etc. What I wanted to ask them was, what about do women in China have two jobs? Namely, do they work in a factory from 9 to 5, and then do they have to go out and shop and do the housework and do the cooking and the second job, what we call it? In some socialist countries, that's a big problem. Their answer was, it's not too big a problem in China. Why? First, of course, they make a distinction with the countryside and the city. Because first thing they point out is before liberation, before the People's Republic, women's status was very, very low in China. And that's true. I mean, the bound foot, etc. So it took time before this old feudal attitude towards women was changed, but they made a special effort to do it. But there are things which operate against the two-job syndrome. For one thing, they don't have refrigeration. They don't have the things that we're accustomed to in our society. So if a woman works and has to do the shopping and the preparing, etc., she would die within a year from overwork. So the husband knows this, you see. So they work cooperatively. It's not uncommon at all in China to see the men do the shopping.
What about child rearing?
Pardon?
Child rearing.
Many children are taken care of by the father. Well, first of all, children are so loved in China that they probably fight among each other who's to take care of the child. I doubt if there's any country in which children are more treated with such great love as in China. In fact, one of the problems that China is going to have psychologically is this one child only in the cities, because to keep the population down. And it's a problem for people who love children so much. The children are beautifully taken care of in China. I judge a society very often how well the children are taken care of. And from that standpoint, China is excellent.
Are they taken care of through daycare systems?
Well, I'm talking about how they look, for one thing. They look healthy, well-dressed, maybe overdressed, and well-fed. Now, they also have something that we could learn from, and that is they have a very good system of daycare. Now, my wife, who knows this well, having been a nursery school teacher herself, asked, what about the training of the teachers? They don't have a sufficient amount of trained teachers. The Cultural Revolution, I don't want to give you the impression that everything was perfect before the Cultural Revolution, and the Cultural Revolution created all the problems. That's not true. But some problems were aggravated by the Cultural Revolution. For example, they didn't believe in training teachers for children. So there were no schools established. Now they have to reestablish the schools. So a lot of the teachers who handle the children in the child care centers are, you might say, baby minders. But they're conscious of this. They want to develop a trained cadre of trained teachers. But there are many, 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 many child care centers. The factories, the shops, any woman that works and has a child doesn't have to worry about it. It's very cheap, and they can put their, or if they can't afford it, they don't have to pay anything. So from that standpoint, we are a backward country. We have to learn to modernize our society from China and other countries where women who work don't have to spend all their money to provide for their children or have to stop working because no one is there to take care of their children. No, in that sense, China is excellent. And the way the children are taken care of, you go to see their nursery schools, they're really marvelous.
Philip Foner is my guest, and we're talking about his recent trip to China. He spent 4 months teaching there. One of the reasons why you were asked to teach in China was for your knowledge on the civil rights movement in America. Now, there are minority groups in China.
Yes.
Is there a civil rights movement or a need for one? Is there a lot of discrimination against the minority groups?
This is something it's, I cannot answer with great insight because I didn't go to the minority sections. From what they tell you, of course, there is no such thing. On the other hand, we know that there are certain more backward tendencies, and they're more not as advanced. And there is one problem which they will admit. And that is a tendency of some of the more developed sections to look down on the minority as not sufficiently civilized. And that they are conscious of, and they try to, or they tell me about it. So I would say that it must be a problem. But I didn't see it myself. What I did see, and I would like to make the following points. I've been to many countries. What is my overall impression of China? I didn't go to all of China. China's a big country. I went to about 8 or 9 cities and to quite a few countryside areas. I would say one thing that struck me and my wife, and because we were in the marketplaces, we went to people's homes. We just didn't go to hotels. We were invited to people's homes. Food-wise, China has done a very good job in feeding its population. There seems to be plenty and ample amount of food for people. Now, wages are very low in China. In some cases, they're ridiculously low. But food prices are also very, very low. In the free markets, which is a complicated story, but still a little higher. But nobody seemed to have lack food, and there were ample supplies of food. And when you consider that China has 1 billion people, give or take a million less, or no one knows exactly, but roughly, and that this was a country which literally had famines again and again and again before liberation, to be able to reach the point of feeding its population so well. China, you won't see Calcutta in China. You won't even see parts of Egypt. Nobody begs in China that we saw. And people seem to have enough to eat. Now, that's not a small achievement for a country like China. Secondly, the clothes. People are well clothed. And ample amount of clothing.
The image I would have is that the clothing is drab and monotonous.
It's not drab. It's good, and it's well suited for the climate. It is not. It's funny about China. For example, Chinese women will make very beautiful clothing out of silk. For winter, they have these down and with et cetera. But they will cover it with a very drab brown or black cover. And when you ask them, they say, it is not considered proper to be conspicuous. So drabness is part of the culture, that you don't stand out. Consequently, it's not surprising to see everybody looking alike in their clothes. But the clothes themselves are very good.
Do you see that as a sign of conformity?
No, I don't think so. I think it's part of the cultural pattern. Now, there were breakings away. If you go to Xi'an, for example, where a lot of tourists come, you see the girls beginning, the young ladies, beginning to wear more colorful clothes. And there's no law against it, by the way. They can wear color of all kinds. It's not in their pattern of thinking, but now they're beginning to. You don't see young ladies wearing lipstick or rouge, but sometimes you will. Sometimes you will. In Shanghai, for example, which has more of a Western tradition, you'll find more of it than anywhere else. So I would say clothing and food-wise, the Chinese have done a very good job. And the department stores, the supply of goods is very diversified and ample and good.
Your main field of expertise is the American labor movement. Are there labor unions in China?
Yes, there are. Of course, they are unions such as existed in all such existed except for Solidarity. They are unions that are linked in with the government apparatus, but they are unions.
Are there conflicts between workers and management, or is there a lot of input?
There probably are. For example, I found in China Daily once a report of a strike. Now, that's incredible, but there was a report. In some area, the workers had gone on strike because when the houses that were built were finished and they had been promised the houses, some of the bureaucrats managed to try to give it to their own pals, you see, and the workers wouldn't take it, and they went on strike. And the government said that their strike was justified. Now, that's unique and very unusual. I would say that we went to many factories. Two or three things impress me about this. One is they say their unions do represent them well. But, of course, nobody can tell just on visit, you see. But one of the things I kept asking was, to what extent are women involved in the work of the unions? And it seems to be pretty good. In fact, one of the things that struck the Chinese, they were just hilarious about this, the Chinese trade union people, men and women, was that for the first time in 100 years of existence, the AFL-CIO last year had appointed a woman to the executive council. They thought that was so incredible that it should take that long for a woman to be in the... And they mentioned we have 8, 9, or 10 women in the top positions. So this to them was a sign of how backward the labor movement was in this respect. So I would think that there are some interesting things we can learn from in that respect. Now, lest you think that everything is perfect in China, no. Housing is terrible by any standards. But still, nobody sleeps in the street. Remember, the housing is very crowded. Poor facilities, poor sanitation. Many people go to public baths. They used to do that in Philadelphia and New York in the turn of the century when immigrants didn't have baths in their home. This is still true in China. And the amount of space that is allowed for each individual family is very, very small. So the housing is a major problem. And they'll agree with you. It's a major problem. We're a poor country. It's going to take a long time till we solve that problem. Yet they do incredible things at times. For example, when we came to Nankai, it's in Tianjin, which had a very serious earthquake in 1976, which devastated a lot of the housing. And a lot of people were living in makeshift houses. For example, the university football field or soccer was no longer usable because a lot of people were living in makeshift houses on it. All over Tianjin, people were living in makeshift houses. Well, they were building new houses for them. And before we left China, we read in the paper that all of the makeshift houses had been eliminated and everybody had been moved. At the same time, nevertheless, the top people in Tianjin said, still, there was a mistake. What? Our government would not take outside help at the time of the earthquake. As a result, we are a year and a half behind in rehousing the people. It's not right to be that isolated that you don't get help. And when I mentioned this to the top officials, they said, yes, that was a mistake. So the other thing that is still a very serious problem is transportation. the transportation. Well, if you put together in a city like Shanghai, where the people are so crowded that every day looks like Christmas shopping in New York, the cars, which are only government cars, nobody owns a private car in China, the buses, the taxis, and the bicycles. The bicycle is the automobile of China. I've seen a four-member of the family bicycle. That is, four members of the family sitting on one bicycle, and not a three-wheeler, a two-wheeler. And the result is mayhem in transportation. People, it might take you an hour and a half to get to work, because the buses are jammed. The traffic moves very slowly because of all this congregation of different forms. So I told the Deputy Premier Gumu, who I had an interview with, I'm convinced that by the time many of the workers get to work, they're already tired. And this is, and they recognize one of their problems. Peking is the only city in China with a subway. And it's expanding, but Tianjin doesn't have one. Shanghai doesn't have one. I did use the Peking subway, and it was an interesting experience. The Chinese went with me, and I went several stations. I wanted to see what it was like. I've been in subways all over the world. And then when I got out, the Chinese said to me, "Well, what do you think of our subway?" And I said, having before China traveled on the subway in New York City, I don't consider this a subway. I said, "Why?" He said, "First, no graffiti. The stations are beautiful, artwork, etc. Secondly, I didn't see one person mugged in all the time that I was on the subway. Thirdly, the train didn't break down. In New York, it always breaks down. So by our standards, this is not a subway. You have to become modernized. Learn how to build a subway where you have graffiti, mugging, and breakdown. Then you'll be able to enter the 20th century like the United States."
We only have a couple of minutes left, but I wonder if you were able to pick up. I know it must have been difficult for you to eavesdrop on conversations since you don't speak Chinese and did a lot of your work with interpreters. But could you tell what kind of political issues were being discussed in the streets?
Very difficult. I would say that one of the political issues that was discussed in the street was the question of the problem of the back door, they call it, that people who have special connections are able to get things easier. That is to say, if your brother-in-law is the manager of the place in the market that has desirable goods, and other people are waiting for two or three days to get it, and you know him, he can slip you something through the back door without your having to wait. That's a big problem, and the government says it's trying to do away with it. For example, one of the back door symbols was many graduates of universities are usually assigned places to go by the government for several years, two or three years, to work, because they have to do certain work after they graduate. The graduates of the middle schools or the high schools are facing unemployment in many cases, but not the graduates of the universities. Well, there was a tendency of professors with pull and others to make sure that their sons and daughters were not sent out to the provinces and stayed in the city they were in. That's the back door. So the government passed an edict while I was there saying that has to stop. No graduate is allowed to interfere with the decision, and any professor who will interfere will be punished. This is equality. When if you talk to the graduate students and the others, and they said, "Well, that's nice. Let's see if it's carried out." In other words, the government has the problem of convincing the people that what they say and what they do are the same thing. So the back door is one of the things they were talking about. The other problem is what they were talking about is what is called the iron rice bowl. And that is, in other words, the idea that no matter what you do on the job, they'll never fire you, so you always have an iron rice bowl. And that is a big problem. And how do you increase productivity? Right? People would tell you of individuals who didn't show up for 4 years in the factory, but got their pay. And then when they were reprimanded, were so angry because the idea was, this is what socialism means, the right to have a job whether you work or not. Well, they're trying to change that. That's another topic of a great deal of discussion.
Well, I regret to say that we're out of time. I really enjoyed hearing about your travels and your perceptions, and I hope to hear what you think about Cuba on this trip when you return.
I promise when I come back, I'll appear again.
Great.